Good morning, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to Smart Talk with Robin and Al. I'm the Robin part of the Robin and Al, and we're here every Saturday at 8 o'clock talking about education, about policy, about what's going on in the world and how it affects us here in Arizona, in our classrooms and all over the state. So I appreciate you joining us. If you want to call in, the number is 790-2040. And on today's show, we'll be talking later in the show with Marilyn Rodriguez on the new voter suppression legislation being proposed up at the Capitol, and there is a lot of it. But first, we're going to talk with Professor Jill Koyama. She's an anthropologist and educator and also the director of the Institute for LGBT Studies at the University of Arizona. She is also, you know, it's interesting, not only is she a cultural anthropologist, but she is currently the Associate Professor in Education Policy Studies and Practice and the Coordinator of Education Leadership Program in the College of Ed. She wrote Making Failure Pay, High Stakes Testing, For-Profit Tutoring and Public Schools, which was published by the University of Chicago. And her second book was U.S. Education in a World of Migration, Implications for Policy and Practice. How do you have this? I mean, you're like assigned to three departments.
Most of my work is interdisciplinary, so in some way it makes sense.
Okay.
So they're all very integrated.
Anyway, thank you for coming in. And well, speaking of integrated, in one of the things I read about you, first of all, I watched your video.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On the immigration stuff. Oh. No, it was very interesting. Everyone should Google that and watch it. But you, one of the things you said is that you focus your research lens on the intersections of social inequities and educational policy. So it's perfect that you're in all these fields. So I was wondering how, first of all, what is the Institute for LGBT Studies do?
Okay.
What are you guys doing?
But first, thanks for having me on this morning, Robin. The Institute is a transdisciplinary center at the University of Arizona, and it brings together researchers, students, faculty, community members to work on issues pertinent to LGBTQ plus populations. And so we do a number of things, if you want me to go on. We have the first trans studies initiative, mm-hmm. and where we've hired a group of faculty and brought in scholars to educate, illuminate, and also work on issues related to the trans community. We have Arizona Queer Archives, which is the only queer archives here in Arizona. And then we do a bunch of programming around queer migration and different research going on in various communities. So it really brings people together to do cool work and think together and collaborate.
Now, has this administration changed what has been going on in schools or at the university? I know that when Betsy DeVos was being interviewed, she said it wasn't the Department of Education's job to prevent discrimination against trans students. And she also said that that wasn't the federal job. And she was kind of harangued about that by Representative Clark, who's in the House. And she was saying, she was trying to get her, there's a school in Indiana, Pence's hometown, where the parents, they get state money, but you cannot be LGBTQ child or have parents who are, unless your parents sign something that says they will abstain. And so Representative Clark kept pushing her and saying, well, would you give federal money to this school? Would that be something you would do? And she would not answer. And Clark kept saying, just say yes or no, yes or no. And she would give these convoluted answers. And then she was asked about African-American. She also would not say yes or no to that. And so how does that kind of attitude impact the work you do?
Right. So that is maybe the national discourse, and that affects Arizona. In Arizona, we are one of the only seven states that has no promo homo law. And essentially what that says is that LGBTQ plus lifeways cannot be discussed. They cannot be portrayed as an alternative to heterosexual lifestyles, and they cannot be portrayed positively. So while that was initially meant to only affect and impact sex education. It actually has been interpreted to be across all topics and all subjects. So in that way, it's particularly sad in that it denies the life that many kids and families are living.
Right. And so that's in K-12.
Yes, that's in K-12. At the university level, I mean, the University of Arizona has been incredibly supportive of the work done at the Institute. And there's, in addition to us, there's also an LGBTQ resource center for students and a women's gender resource center. So across the university, there's lots of supports. Of course, there's still issues around even using someone's correct pronoun or faculty not acknowledging correct pronouns. And there's places that are not safe. And so while we have these pockets of safety, including the Institute, there are a lot of places on campus where students, especially trans students and LGBTQ students, don't feel safe.
And those students are adults, or, you know,
yes,
young adults. But for K through 12 kids, where there's no counselors in the schools, and this must be pretty tragic.
Yeah, I think in one way it's incredibly horrifying for all students, right? Not to get the education about different possibilities, but also it can be incredibly frightening for students and families who maybe feel like they're not gendered in the right ways, or that they're don't fit into the gender binary that's often presented to them, even on school forms, let alone, as we know, schools are often segregated by girls, boys, for events, for different sports. And so their entire lives at school, which we know they spend a lot of time at school, is really denying who they are or who they might be, and doesn't offer them that possibility of exploring it.
And aren't LGBTQ kids more likely to be bullied, harassed?
Yes, absolutely. And they're more likely to do self-harm because of that, and more likely to try and commit suicide. And when they do try, they, I think 40% more likely to have to actually get medical care. So it's a really serious issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, it's interesting, one of the legislators last week up in Phoenix was talking about how she was talking as a, not as a legislator, but she was testifying in front of another committee as a parent. And she said that she felt that that children are more likely to be harassed by LGBTQ students.
I've never seen any studies to support that. That would be difficult for me to believe at this point.
Yes.
Yes.
So right now in our state, we are not allowed with sex ed in high schools. You know, when you said that, I was surprised because I didn't know we still had sex ed in high schools. I thought that had gone away.
Actually, it begins much earlier in middle school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily think that it is a separate course so much as integrated into the health courses.
Oh, I was thinking math.
Yeah, math. social studies.
Yes. So you've probably heard that Karen Pence, our vice president's wife, has gone back to work, and which is amazing and pretty great, because you'd think she'd be really busy. But I know that Biden's wife also was a teacher or a professor. But she's teaching in a school that is another school that does not allow LGBTQ students, parents, and does get money from the state. So do you see us moving in any way that gets us away from that?
It's interesting and also sad, but I feel like the trend in society is in the opposite direction of that, right? And if we look even at the indicators for society and even marriage equality and some of the other movements, it seems like society is moving in the other direction, while this particular administration and some pockets in education have gone in the opposite direction to be more constrictive. So I actually think there's a movement away from that. Uh-huh. However, there are still going to be those very solidly staunch anti-gay perspectives that infiltrate education.
And as a professor, do you feel that, like, this generation that's after us, Although my generation was pretty great. But
the greatest.
The greatest. No, not the greatest. That's my mother's.
Yeah.
We're the sub-greatest. We're the ones that destroyed the world. That when I talk to people who are younger than me, they're just blown away because this has no, they are totally open.
Yes.
And just, you know, are shocked that their parents or someone else would feel that this would be something to be prejudiced about or afraid of or
avoid. You know, I think that millennials and the younger generations definitely get a bad rap for not being civically engaged, for not having political ideas. And I see just the opposite, actually. And I see them as being more open, as being more progressive, as being more oriented toward the world and the environment and social justice and equity than likely my generation and my parents' generation for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it is very shocking that we still have this other thing going on, and that unfortunately those people are in positions of power.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it fits into this larger racism, xenophobia, homophobia. It's all part of similar threads of hatred and discrimination. And so right now, we know that the discourse at the national level, anyway, from certain politicians just breeds that. And we're seeing that filter down through all the states, but Arizona probably as one in particular.
A few years ago, this gentleman, Dan Savage, who writes a column
Savage
on...
Savage Love.
Yes, yeah, Savage Love. But he started this movement called It Gets Better because there were a number of suicides. And in Arizona, we had a senator and a representative, and one of the senator's sons did a video of him and what it was like for his parents. And his mother had run the anti-gay marriage thing here. And it was interesting to see what happened and how he had fought this, but also that his father had said to him eventually, he goes, "I'm not ready for marriage yet, but I will be."
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's a great project, and you can still see those videos online. And it's essentially people like me, LGBTQ plus adults who are trying to send a message to the youth that, like, we have great lives, we have loving families, we have great friends. Yeah, we've had some hard time, but it does get better.
Yes.
For many of us, thankfully. Yeah.
We're going to go for a quick break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about migration.
Okay.
Okay. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Dr. Jill Koyama. And if you have a question, call in at 790-2040. Oh, hi, we're back. Sorry, I was waiting for a signal, a better signal. I mean, a signal I understood more than the card and I was reading. So you're listening to Smart Talk, and today's guest is Professor Jill Koyama, who published and co-edited the U.S. Education in a World of Migration, Implications for Policy and Practice. Is there another word that comes after that? I put a comma.
I don't think so.
Okay. So one of the things you said is that your work is situated across three integrated strands of inquiry: the productive social assemblage of policy, the controversies of globalizing educational policy, and the politics of language policy. So, and you talk about how your research has been focused on, you know, these people coming not just to this country, but all over. And the kind of circumstances they face and what they actually do, which is different than what we imagine. What we hear again on the national dialogue is, you know, people are coming to, you know, take your jobs and become criminals, and that's not what your research says.
No, not at all. Well, you've really researched me. This could be scary this morning. I think in the academy and also in education, we often look at what people can't do, what kids can't do in school, what people can't do. And I'm much more interested in what they do. Mm-hmm. And so my work with refugees and undocumented migrants shows me that they're great at putting together networks, accessing resources, advocating for their children, and really making a life. And given the circumstance in which they've brought here and the trauma they've had, that's quite amazing.
Yes.
Right? And especially with the recent anti-immigrant sentiments and the executive orders and the reduction in the cap on refugees, the ones that do come to me are amazing in that way. Yeah.
So could you talk about the difference between refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, immigrants, that mm-hmm. whole spectrum?
Yeah. So unfortunately in popular media and also in academics too, that those words are used interchangeably and mm-hmm. they aren't. So if we talk about, when I speak of migrants, that is anyone who is moving maybe not even out of their country, but who in some way has been displaced or needed to flee. So that could be internally displaced people. Mm-hmm. That could be people who are seeking asylum in another country, and I'll talk about that. Or that could be refugees, which is a totally different status. Right now, we have the highest number ever. There's about 65 million migrants. And a large portion of that are internally displaced. So what that means is that they still live within their country, but they have been forced to flee their home, usually from violence, war, genocide. I don't say those things lightly, but so
Yemen and like
Sudan,
Eritrea.
So the asylum seekers are people who flee their countries. Even if you think of the Central American migrants who have shown up at our southern border, and they have not yet gotten the status, they want to present themselves and be allowed to present themselves and seek asylum. At that point, the process will start to see if they can verify a case that would give them that status. Refugees, on the other hand, have already fled their country, usually gone to a refugee resettlement camp or another country, mm-hmm. and have already been vetted through that process, and have been shown to have reason that they cannot go home and that they should be resettled. Right, so asylum seekers will start the process once they would get, let's say, here. Refugees have already done the process. By the time they come here, they already have the refugee status.
And so when people are refugees in their own country or a country next to them,
mm-hmm.
how long do they stay there?
Ah, that's a really interesting point. I think most people think of the word refugee as this very transitionary, mm-hmm. and maybe liminal, but the average, it has fluctuated, but the average was 17 years that a family, from the time the family left the home to the time that they were resettled in a third country. So sometimes all of their children are born in refugee camps, mm-hmm. right? And those, you know, especially in Kenya with the largest camps, and recently in the Middle East. So we tend to think that United States is, or Europe is what we see in the news, getting most of the migrants and most of the refugees, but that's actually not true. Mm-hmm. They're actually in adjacent countries, so like Turkey, Jordan. So those have received a lot of people fleeing.
Right.
So the time can be really long.
And some of them are very poor and can't, fly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over.
And even when their flight is paid for them to, say, come to the U.S., they have to repay that back over time. Yeah.
Wow.
So you can imagine how expensive that could be.
And so Arizona, so Tucson, I know, has a number of programs for these families who come, like in schools, mm-hmm. and what happens, because they have unique problems with fitting in, because as you said, some of them have been in a refugee camp for 17 years. Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with any of the programs that help kids acclimate?
Yeah, so Tucson, we're fortunate. Arizona actually is among the top four or five states in the U.S. to receive refugees, which is pretty amazing given Arizona. And in Tucson, there are three different refugee resettlement agencies, and they work closely with school districts. If I just take TUSD as an example, they have an entire department devoted mm-hmm. To refugee students and their families, giving them academic support, social support, helping the families access social services. And so that's pretty amazing. Most of the people who work there have been refugees themselves and are multilingual. So while the students, the refugee students come, most of them had severe interrupted formal education.
Right.
Many times they don't have much education. They mostly don't speak English, but they're multilingual. They are very resilient. They're hardworking and they're eager. So that combination bodes well for them.
And how does that work? If you've grown up in a refugee camp, sometimes in a country that has a different language than yours, and let's say you're 14,
mm-hmm.
you don't have a lot of time left.
So that is one of the main issues, is that many of the refugees have been in a refugee camp, learned the language of that country, mm-hmm. as opposed to still have their home language. When they get here, it's very difficult to get all the credits they need in order to graduate and meet the Arizona State standards. So many of them do credit recovery programs, which are essentially online. Not a great way to learn. And then we don't have a gap for those who age out.
Yeah.
And so right now I'm working with Julie Casper, who used to be the coordinator of center downtown, and she is a doctoral student. And we're going to start a micro center on campus to offer tutoring and GED to that population that basically has aged out.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I think Pima County also does that. Literacy Connects. There's a number of organizations. Tucson is really strong that way.
Now, you said that we're like in the top four of states that receive
yes.
Refugees. How were we chosen?
Yeah, right. It really surprised me when I moved here. So I moved here from New York, uh-huh. which is one of the top receiving. And I was so surprised. But then when I looked into it a bit, it made sense to me, because a couple of the factors are, do we have low-cost housing? Yes. Do we have service jobs, which tend to be low-wage, but they don't require a great amount of English and education? Yes. So we think about those. So it's very cheap to live here, and you can get a job. So that made sense to me, actually.
One of the things you talked about is with these people who come and don't speak our language and have lived in a camp, and then once they get here, they get involved in community and civic engagement.
Yeah, that, you know, that was a surprising finding as well for me. So when they are resettled here, and we have about in Arizona about 70,000 refugees currently living here, and about half of them are women and children.
Mm-hmm.
So in Tucson, they tend to live in concentrated areas, in large apartment complexes, and while in that way it's segregating in one way, in another way it allows them to be together and to have services there and to start doing community action.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So many of the youth in particular become involved in everything from human rights to water rights. And I was really surprised by that, actually. But that's something that makes sense when you think about what they have gone through.
Right.
So they almost come here as activists.
Like water rights, they're, you know, the CAP, they think we should get more than...
I think because they do certain projects in schools,
uh-huh.
but it also is just also their close proximity to local organizations that are also involved in that. So often churches, community organizations uh-huh. that are doing work around that are also the same ones that serve the refugees.
So that's great that they come and actually are adding to the community, not what we're hearing of, you know, they're sucking.
Certainly. Yeah, I mean,
out.
There is the myth that they are a threat to our economy. They're going to take our jobs. They're a threat to our life ways, to our American culture. And then they're also often seen, if they're Muslim, as a threat to our own security. Mm-hmm. And none of these things have been shown in any study to be true.
Okay. We're going to go for a quick break. And we will be back with Professor Jill Koyama, and we'll talk to you in a second. Thanks. Bye. We're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we're here every Saturday. Next week, Al's going to be here, and we're talking with Dr. Jill Koyama, and she also wrote a book, among all of her other things. You're the most diverse researcher on the planet.
I'm not, but thank you.
Jill, we bow to you. About high-stakes testing, making failure pay, high-stakes testing for profit tutoring and public schools.
Yeah.
In case you want to read the book.
Yeah.
Or you could just listen right now.
Yeah, so at the time I was living in New York City, and that was early stages of No Child Left Behind, mm-hmm. the federal education policy. And one of the mandates in there was schools, Title I schools that were not meeting their objectives had to offer supplemental educational services, SES, which basically was tutoring. And almost immediately, companies like Princeton Review, Kaplan, they all started becoming vendors in New York. And this was across the country. And so our public dollars, our taxpayer dollars that we pay to public education were then paid to those companies to come in and do these after-school SES programs. Millions and millions and millions of dollars. So
yes,
the more kids that failed the standardized tests, the more had to be mandated to actually take this right. after-school tutoring.
And some of the people who set that up were also tests from companies that actually made
yes.
the test and could determine what question can no one answer. New York and Arizona had the same test for a while. And they, remember, the country was divided
yes.
into two testing. This is after No Child Left Behind. And they had, and we had the same one as New York, but we were a year behind. And New York published a lot of the test questions. And for first graders, they had 12 language arts sections. And one of them was ancient civilizations. And this was for first graders. And one of the questions was, explain the significance of the Code of Hammurabi. And so I started asking adults this. Can you tell me what the significance of, really, two people out of the hundreds I asked. And what was interesting is I would talk to people and they'd say, you can train a child to answer that question, but they will have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah,
they definitely can give the answer.
You can train people to take tests.
Uh-huh.
And actually, those same companies that I mentioned offer, you know, they've been known for years and years for test prep. And basically, they teach you this strategy of taking tests that has nothing to do with learning. Right? It's like you can eliminate these two questions and not this question. Yeah. And so in some ways, like educated, informed guessing based on probability. But it doesn't mean that you at all learn the material. So
uh-huh.
some kids can test very well. Most not so much, especially under those high stakes conditions. We spend so much time testing kids that takes away from actually learning and teaching right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, it's stressful for some kids, but it limits what teachers can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to, their livelihood depends on how well these kids are going to do on the test.
Yeah.
And I am very grateful that my middle son did not have to go have his teachers. He was beloved by his teachers and has a really creative brain. But if the teachers had to use his tests as part of their salary, they would not have been as happy to see him come in the class.
I mean, I think that's why we saw so much scandal with this. So we saw in Baltimore, the superintendent and a group of principals and teachers, she ended up actually getting jailed, that they were changing the scores.
Yes, one of the few people in the country that went to jail for that.
Yeah, a woman of color.
They were all
mm-hmm.
five of them.
Mm-hmm. We know that in New York, they actually changed the benchmark so that more kids would pass.
Oh, they lowered it?
Yes.
Yes. And so why are we surprised with these cheating tests where people are paying $15,000 to $500,000, which has been going on for a long time? They used to offer buildings to get a kid into college.
Yes.
And now I guess there's this other route.
You know, that's just, to me, it wasn't surprising. Of course, it's horrifying, but it's not surprising at all because this goes on at different levels continually. And it doesn't, even the coverage of it has annoyed me because it hasn't got to the root causes of inequity about who gets to go to college in the first place.
Right.
So,
especially when there's conversation about free college for all at the moment. Do you think that's going to happen?
I don't. However, that would be wonderful.
And the other thing about the high stakes tests and the standardized test is that we actually have a standardized test, the NAEP, which is given randomly, given to a a portion, a piece of the students.
Fourth and eighth graders, and they take a sample that's representative of the entire country. And interestingly, as No Child Left Behind, as those scores were going up and up and up in many states, NAEP scores were staying the same. And so there's certainly a problem there. And there's a number of researchers that have looked at that and pointed that out.
Yeah. Well, in Arizona, you said that they were now moving to some SATs, some ACTs, but there are colleges now that are saying we don't need those tests.
Yeah, those tests, as well as the graduate record exam that we use, are not great indicators of how well a student will do or how creatively and critically they think. And so we tend to have those standardized tests, and companies make a lot of money off of them, but they're still not a good indicator of someone's knowledge or ability to learn. So it's troubling, actually, to me that Arizona has replaced one test, high stakes test, for another, or depending
exactly
on what district you're in, there's even different tests.
And also Arizona, along with eight other states, has a high-stakes exit exam for third graders.
Yeah, move on when reading.
Move on when reading, or hold back.
Yes, in which you can be held back at third grade, which is psychologically and emotionally just so damaging to
a child. Someone once told me that being held back was the equivalent emotionally to, it was right below death of a parent and right above having an accident in front of your peers.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, this is not good. But we keep moving towards that direction, and this is the standard. Even though under our voucher program, we give these vouchers so people can opt out of the public schools and go into private schools where they're not required to take those tests.
Yeah, it's really a distorted public education system we have right now, very dominated by these very neoliberal kind of competitive, high stakes, high accountability measures that to me unfortunately takes away what I think can be amazing things happening in education, right? When kids are allowed to learn and explore and teachers are allowed to do that along with them and guide them, amazing things happen in classrooms.
Do you still think that this is allowed in schools for teachers to have the opportunity to do these amazing things and creative things and share their passions? Because that's who I remember as teachers, the ones who had some passion that might not have been yours, but was fascinating to learn about.
Yeah, I mean, I think great teachers are great teachers, and teachers still do tremendous things and work those sorts of things in, but they must be worked in to what's already this very scripted curriculum. I mean, what page you're on that day, what topic is covered, and that standardization. To me, as a teacher, I would think it would just be soul-crushing, and yet they do it, and for very little pay, as we know, and their commitment. I mean, I don't believe I could do the work of most of the teachers that I have studied.
Well, it's emotionally exhausting, and also the compassion they feel for their students. I mean, that's shown from everything from bringing food in for kids to putting themselves in harm's way to protect children.
Yes.
And yet we've been demonizing teachers for about 15 years. And even the other day someone was saying, anyway, I'm not going to repeat that.
I think that is an ongoing demonization, is if you portrayed it, that either when kids don't do well or things aren't going well, we either blame their parents, right, or the teachers, right? And those seem to be the two easy suspects for society rather than tackling the broader social issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like poverty.
Yes, poverty. Yes.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a second. And you're listening to Smart Talk, and we will be back very soon. Thank you. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we will soon be joined by Marilyn Rodriguez, who is up at the Capitol a lot, fighting for democracy. She works with Arizona Wins, with Lucha, and with CHSPA, and she is going to talk about some of the bills that are up in the legislature that are not exactly what we'd consider keeping our republic and our democracy going. So, Marilyn, hello.
Hi there.
Hi, thank you for joining us on a Saturday morning. I'm sitting here with Professor Jill Koyama, and we're Can you tell us about some of the bills that are going through?
Yes, there's actually a whole handful. Some have sputtered out, one's on the governor's desk, and others were still fighting. And they're all following kind of the same theme, which is that, you know, we as progressives saw greater victories electorally this past election cycle than we ever had previously, or in, I think, in multiple generations. And the result is these pieces of legislation to chip away at, and it's almost like death by a thousand cuts, our access across the board to the ballot. And the Republicans know it. This will have a disproportionate impact on folks who are not their demographic. So they're unabashedly pursuing, I think, some pretty egregious pieces of legislation.
What's weird about it is that these are the people who are elected, and they are so anti-voter. It's as though they feel these people aren't bright enough because they voted for me, and obviously that wasn't a good thing.
Oh, that is a common explanation we hear, actually, when voters pass citizens' initiatives, and there are a few attacks on citizens' initiatives. I'll often hear from, it's always conservatives, they'll say the voters didn't know what they were voting for. They constantly claim that we are too dumb to understand what we're doing when we show up on election day or vote early. So, I mean, in that theme, right, you have three bills, SB 1451, which is an attempt to add additional ways that somebody can take a citizens' initiative into court and sue to delegitimize the validity of citizen signatures. So if you are a paid or volunteer signature gatherer, you already have a whole litany of very, very strict rules to comply with. And in the event that you do not comply with those rules, the whole sheet that you turn in can be tossed out, right? So all of those signatures that you had collected to qualify for the ballot would therefore then be in question or would be tossed out. So the Arizona Chamber of Commerce attempted, and we saw this last election cycle with Prop 127 and then, of course, with Prop 305 on the Save Our Schools side, where you had these very powerful interests go to court and try to flex the muscle of the statutes that they had recently passed to, for arbitrary reasons, throw out signatures. And so we have another bill that would, the Secretary of State's office is saying it will take them about $3 million of staff time to comply each year or each cycle, that would add additional burdens on signature gatherers, such as turning everything in order as opposed to just all together. So in the event, you know, and I don't know if folks listening are familiar with the signature gathering process or the signature turn-in process, but often you turn in thousands and thousands and thousands of sheets. And often those sheets are compiled by volunteers. And if even one sheet is out of place, all of those signatures would be suddenly subject to being invalidated, which we just think is absolute nonsense.
And isn't part of it that, let's say you're collecting with someone, you're collecting signatures like on opposite sides of the street or something, and there's collector A and collector B, and one of collector B's sheets gets in with collector A's, then those are thrown out?
If the campaign does not catch it before turning it into the Secretary of State's office, then if this legislation passes, yes, all of that work you did would be thrown out.
It's unbelievable. I always think of Arizona because we have that Voter Protection Act, that this is the one area that we have some strength in Arizona to get things passed that the people are interested in.
Yes, and that's true, and these powerful interests know it. That's why this session, you have the Chamber of Commerce, the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, I should say, pushing this piece of legislation beyond all others. This is their priority this year. I've seen them lobbying this down there every single day. And when I'm talking to conservatives who agree that the citizens' initiative process, there's a few of them, who agree that the citizens' initiative process is something to be preserved, but then I tell them, hey, a really powerful interest is behind it, they get very squeamish and they say, I can't do this alone.
Wow. Do you want to talk about what the bill that is going after the permanent early voting list, the PEVL?
Yes. So this one is actually moving through the process. Whereas the other, it's unclear if that has the votes to pass at this moment in time, thankfully. But we try to keep the pressure on because, goodness, it is a difficult, difficult time at the legislature, especially when you're trying to fight about a dozen or less bills that attack our access to the ballot. So on 1188, SB 1188, sponsored by Senator Ujjanti Rita, she has approximately seven bills that are somewhat of an attack on the ballot initiative process or the voter registration or the voting process. 1188 would require the recorders to purge voters from the permanent early voting list if they miss or sit out two election cycles. So you often have voters who opt to vote in person, right? They get their permanent early ballot. They either hold on to it too long or hold on onto it long enough because they want to do their research. This, in effect, would punish that voter for taking their time and then opting to vote on election day.
So it's not even that they've missed two elections. It's that they've missed getting their ballot in for a specific election. That's one count against you. And if you get another one, you're off the list.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Yes,
is there what do you think? This is Jill. What do you think is are the best ways to get this information out about this pending legislation to the general public?
I think shows like yours help. We have been calling everyone and anyone, just saying, listen, the permanent early voting list is very popular. People like receiving their ballot in the mail, and they probably would be pretty upset to find out that they're being kicked off for any reason, even in situations where they may have voted. So we have created fact sheets. The Arizona Advocacy Network, azadvocacy.org, has a whole bunch of resources online that people can use to, you know, get the word out. They include fact sheets. There's calls to action. And we have, you know, of course, paid Facebook ads going, Twitter ads. We have patch through calls going. But really the best thing that people can do is get out there, let your friends and neighbors know what the legislature's up to, and then call your lawmakers at the state legislature and let them know that you're not going to put up with this. And this includes not just your senator, but your two representatives as well, right? So that's three calls you would have to make to make it known that you absolutely oppose the concept of being purged from the permanent early voting list for any reason.
Great. Thank you.
Now, what's interesting about Senate Bill 1188 and the sponsor is that particular sponsor has a lot of Pebble voters in her district.
Thousands.
You would think this would be working against her.
Well, and that's the thing, is they know, and I think suspect that, you know, they think they're safe. I think we are experiencing an interesting phenomenon at the legislature where they're pursuing legislation that is clearly intent on maintaining their grip on power. And I view it as them running scared. But when you talk to them and they talk about purging voters, they think that will make them more safe, right? And I'm not so sure they're wrong. Their electorate, in particular in Scottsdale, right, you have usually older voters who are white, who vote very early or on election day. So they're used to having that habitual ability to vote. They don't move around, so they don't have to re-register all the time or think to re-register. They are often able and have the time in the event that they don't get a ballot, right? They have the time and resources to go figure out where their ballot is. And then, frankly, they have the time and resources to vote on election day. And many of the voters on the progressive side, right, we have obstacles that we have to overcome constantly. We're either moving, have a change of address, have a change of name. We have to work two to three jobs on election day. Keeping track of a ballot envelope can be a challenge, right? The obstacles are far greater on our side, and they know it.
So you said that Senator Ujjanti Rita had nine bills that were of this ilk. What are some of the others that we should know about?
So another one includes SB 1046, If passed, it would say that if you are on the permanent early voting list and you receive a ballot in the mail, that you may not drop it off in person. I am not joking. You have SB 1072 that was on the governor's desk when we spoke yesterday, Robin, and he has since signed it. It expands that voter ID law to early polling locations, where it used to be the case, and this is really going to disproportionately impact students, the elderly, and tribal nations, where it used to be the case that you could come in to an early polling location before Election Day and use your Social Security number, your passport ID, your military ID, your tribal ID to verify your identity. Now, none of those are valid, nor is your signature. So we're going to have way more provisional ballots probably voted at these early polling locations, especially on tribal nations. And I'm very concerned about the impact that's going to have on the right to vote for these populations. You also have SB 1090. That one is also moving, which would require a voter to affirm or attest to the validity of their emergency in the event they needed to emergency vote. So, you know, current law says that recorders and elections officials have to shut down early voting by the Friday before the Tuesday election day. Well, there are some instances, and this exists now, where if you are a voter experiencing an emergency and you contact your recorder, they can come out to you and help you vote, right? This often happens in settings of hospitals, right? An individual may be experiencing a death in the family, all the way down to, you know what, there's going to be a blizzard. I am very elderly. I don't have access to transportation. I can't get to the polling place on Tuesday, and I really want to vote, right? The recorder can then come out and help you vote. Well, now what you would have to do is attest and affirm to the validity of that emergency. And what we're very concerned about, and I think others should be as well, is your privacy, your right to privacy as
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you don't
voter.
Want to tell them why you can't vote on that day.
Right. And also, maybe you don't want to be at risk of being pulled into court when political hacks from a certain campaign, right? Say you emergency voted in a very close race. We've seen this happen on the signature gathering side, right? If it's close, the other side is going to do everything they can to invalidate your vote. So now you're possibly facing the experience of being dragged into court and having the validity of your emergency picked apart. And you have folks who are incentivized then to try to undermine it. And I just think that is wrong.
So just to clarify, Senate Bill 1072, that was signed by the governor.
Yes.
That's happened.
Just last night, that's happened. So 1072 is the one that expands that voter ID law to early voting. So now you can only use certain forms of ID. You can't use a military card, a passport, tribal ID, student ID. You can't use those.
And you said the greatest impact, who's going to be impacted that the most? Students, tribal nations, and elderly.
Yes, those without... like especially elderly who don't drive, right? You may have a non-operating ID or usually we see these individuals have their passport cards, right? That doesn't have your address on it, mostly because it doesn't need to. But now suddenly you've been issued this ID by the government that is, you know, you are who you say you are. And the legislature has now said that isn't enough to vote, to exercise your right to vote.
So, Marilyn, we only have a few more minutes. So, could you, give the website address of Arizona Advocacy or the phone numbers of who people should call, the number for everyone in the legislature that they can then be patched into, or some way for people to get in contact with their legislators and make those three calls?
Yes, of course. So, it's azadvocacy.org. And then before you call, and I'm going to give you the number, before you call the legislature for information on how to be patched through to your lawmaker, if you go to azledge.gov and click on Find My Legislator, in the event you don't know who they are, please find that out first. And then go ahead and call the information desk at the Capitol and ask to be patched through to them. And the number there, I'll give it to you, is 602 602-926-4221.
602-926-4221.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the information desk to the Capitol.
And are there any other bills that you're looking at, now that we have that, that you think people should be aware of?
Yes, there are two more. And if I had more time, I'd have a longer list for you. And like I said, at azadvocacy.org, there's the full list as well. But there are two bills. There are referrals, HCR 2005 and SCR 1023. They're a mirror bill, which means that they are exactly duplicate. These scared us because when mirror bills move through the legislature, they fast-track the process. So it takes about half the time to pass these bills as it does a traditional bill that would have to move through one body to the other. They both changed the rules for signature gathering. Currently, our threshold is you have to get 10% of the qualified electors from the previous general election. Now what it would do is say that you have to get 10% from each and every legislative district, which they know is impossible.
Yes.
And also gives a disproportionate veto from big towns to small towns and small towns to big towns. So in committee, we
just like the Electoral College, but in small form. Marilyn, thank you so much for sharing all this information. We have like 2 seconds left. Thank you, Jill Koyama and Marilyn Rodriguez, for coming on. I really appreciate it. We'll see you next week at 8 a.m. Bye-bye.